This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me for the top half of the show is Will Bentley.
Hello.
And later on, you'll be hearing the dulcet tones of Richard Hawes. So this week, we're going to be kicking off with three films. So we're going to be looking at Tokyo Dragon Chef. Then we're going to be moving on to Silence and Darkness. And then we're going to round off the reviews with Sator. Our short shot this week is a film called Highway Violence. And our DTV throwback is going to be Warlock 2 Armageddon. So, without further ado, let's crack on. Okay, I'm joined by Will Bentley to talk about the film Tokyo Dragon Chef, being released by Terracotta Distribution. Our old friend Jerry Terracotta, who you met, probably remember, Will, we met quite a while ago.
Yeah,
one of the film festivals that we attended back in the old days before the blight of COVID, etc. But yeah, so they're still going strong. This and this particular release, I think, should go down very well. So what we have here is two brothers, although I do believe they're brothers by different mothers, Tatsu and Ryu. Tatsu is just getting out of prison and he's met by Ryu in a very decent pastiche of the film The Blues Brothers. In fact, a lot of this film is kind of built around this sort of The Blues Brothers sort of format. So Tatsu and Ryu are ex-Yakuza. The old gangs have been destroyed. We'll get into that a bit later on. So Ryu is now driving a little sort of takeaway van selling Nata de Coco, I believe, which is kind of like a bubble tea kind of thing. And he wants he and his brother to sort of open a Chinese restaurant and start selling ramen noodles. So Will, this film sort of like defies a lot of expectations, I believe. You know, starting off with that sort of like Blues Brothers pastiche, and then breaking out into song and dance, which is just like very bizarre.
It's really strange. I mean, it's really it doesn't just defy definition. It's coming close to defying description. It's just so weird. The Blues Brothers thing at the beginning was actually really, that kind of pastiche on him coming out of jail and sort of everything's changed kind of thing, was really cutely done, and it was a really good way to introduce both the two main characters, Tatsu and Ryu, and their kind of their personalities. And the strange little half world that the film is set in, this kind of odd kind of suburban, Yakuza playground.
It is, isn't it? Because it's off the beaten path, isn't it? The little restaurant is this sort of little corner sort of place, in a very sort of nondescript street. Yeah. It's away from the usual sort of hustle and bustle of things. Even though they do sort of pull in, they end up pulling in quite a few customers, sort of thanks to, in part, a YouTuber. It's called Nose. It comes in and, he tries their wares and blogs about it, and all of a sudden people want to sort of come and try it, which is quite amusing.
I thought it was good that that whole social media angle seems, completely relevant and not forced at all. It was like oh yeah, of course they would do that nowadays. Why wouldn't you? Everyone does that. Do you know what I mean? It's like
absolutely
perfectly normal.
There's a Korean series on YouTube we watched recently which had a sort of similar sort of thing about setting up this restaurant. I can't remember what it was called now. That was really good. That was a really, really useless aside. That was without being able to back up any sort of facts or anything.
I know, I was going
to
say, or even name the film. Yeah, it's such a good film. We can't remember the name.
Oh boy, that's my memory for you. Yeah, but yeah, there's, you know, so many sort of lovely little bits. Even when, you know, Tatsu's getting out of prison, you know, and he's putting his old Yakuza clothes on, you know, the snazzy suit, the outlandish shirt and that. And there's this sound effect of like a gun cocking as he puts his sunglasses on, you know.
for no reason.
For no reason, but, you know, as he puts sunglasses on, you hear this sort of thing, you know. It was quite funny. But then you see his brother outside wearing this sort of apron and little bow tie, you know, because he's running.
Yeah, in the most hilarious little takeaway van that he's got. That exactly. Just, you know, because that whole conversation, like, where's the Mercedes?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's Blues Brothers again, you know. So what do you do with it? Yeah. yeah, and it's quite funny. There's a bit early on as well where this drunken couple come and start ordering a stupid number of bloody, you know, coconuts, basically, because, you know, these are like, as I said, you know, they're like bubble tea kind of things. And this guy's going, yeah, I want 10 of these. And he's like, yeah. And, you know, you and I have worked in the service industry.
Yeah.
You know, we're veterans of Wetherspoons. We used to have this kebab shop next door, and we're very aware of the sort of, you know, our customers becoming their customers kind of thing. And this sort of shit happening. Yeah, our 10, yeah. Sort of like,
yeah, sort yeah, yeah. You know exactly where the conversation, you know exactly where the conversation's going. And it's just like, brilliant.
Yeah, that's very funny. But yeah, no, it's really good. So yeah, we've got these other outlandish characters coming in. So as we mentioned, we've got sort of this YouTuber who has a few scenes. This girl called Kokoro, who's a... seems to be a schoolgirl, but absolutely addicted to noodles, to ramen noodles, and
to quite an astonishing degree.
Yeah, she even breaks out into song about it twice, I believe.
That was a surprise to me. It really did. It became a musical, and you know, it was a really weird musical as well.
Because... It was, and you know, the songs are pretty catchy, even though they're in sort of Japanese. And the second one she sings, you know, when there's this sort of fight breaking out, and she starts singing, and it is basically it's a version of Aretha Franklin's respect song the Blues Brothers, you know. It's got the same, almost the same tune, but not, you know, but enough to sort of go, yeah, I can see what you're doing there.
Yeah,
it's just really cool. So she gets some sort of interesting little scenes. Across the road we have two other rivals who turn up. So, well, I say two other brothers, I should say, who turn up.
They're also ex-Yakuza, aren't they?
Ex-Yakuza, and they almost have this sort of identical conversation, you know, because Ryu and Tatsu have this conversation in the bathhouse at the beginning, where he's sort of saying, "I think we should open a Chinese restaurant and sell ramen noodles." Yeah. And then you have these two other guys, who are probably about 20 years older than they are, you know, having the same conversation. I think we should have ditched the Yakuza and open a restaurant.
They're down on the look for exactly the same reason as Tatsu and Ryo, though.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this guy called Gazumo, who we see a sort of flashback of when he was sort of younger, and you know, he's been put upon by some Yakuza thugs, and he decides to form his own gang to take out all the Yakuza. And while Tatsu's been away in prison, that's exactly what he's been doing, and taking over the neighborhoods and things like this, with this sort of very outlandish costume. He's carved this like third eye into his forehead, and then all his followers wear these sort of giant eyeball masks, which is actually quite reminiscent of another Japanese series called 20th Century Boys.
I missed that reference, but I was trying to work out. I was certain that I'd seen something similar.
Yeah, I know. Because I think you did see those ones, because that was like a two-parter or a three-parter. I can't remember now. That was quite a few years ago, but it was very good. So that was sort of a reference to that kind of. But he's this whiny little shit, basically. I think he's probably the weakest link in the film is that he's, you know, despite his actions, he doesn't seem that much of a threat to these guys, really.
Physically, no, he's not. But he's just really manipulative, and he's managed to, you know, he's managed to get where he is by just being this sneaky little sod, basically. that's what he's done.
Absolutely. Yeah. So another character we need to mention that turns up is this girl called Mimi, who helps out the Ozawa brothers, the sort of the rivals across the street. They've gone a sort of different route with their food, whereas sort of Tatsu as the chef is trying these sort of innovative ways of sort of cooking up ramen noodles, you know, inspired by his days in prison, basically.
He won the awards. He won the championships while in prison.
That's it. So the other two across the street, who are Kazu and Zin, Ozawa brothers, they've gone for sort of just big flavors, basically. It's like, it doesn't matter how shit the food is, as long as it's, you know, plentiful and sort of meaty kind of thing. So it's just, you know, whereas Tatsu's plates, you know, are relatively sort of artistic, you know, so wouldn't look out of place on sort of like MasterChef Japan sort of thing. You know, these guys are just like this huge mound of noodles and slabs of pork. But because Mimi comes along and is another YouTuber who is sort of famous for being able to pack away huge amounts of food, you know, she helps them become an overnight sensation as well, but sort of just eating these stupid amounts, piles and piles of bloody, you know, sort of noodles and slabs of meat. So it's just quite amusing, but it works.
It does. The interest in the food and actually, you know, the food being important and like little kind of tropes and sketches on the food is a big feature I've noticed in like sort of when Asian cinema does a kind of food themed thing, you know, and you sort of like, you don't need to be an expert or whatever. These are like homages to the food,
yeah,
you know, and to the place that food has in society and stuff. And, you know, like a lot of there's clearly a lot of pride in, you know, the food that they're talking about and how it's done. And it kind of reminds me, I mean, it's the first thing like this that I saw was that Chinese feast years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
That you, I think you, I don't know, you learned that.
Yeah, I've got that.
You know, but it does. This is like a comedy gangster action, you know, thriller about battling noodle restaurants, but they're actually really bothered about, you know, about the place that food has in it.
Yeah, there's two scenes in particular that sort of stand out with that. There's if you remember back in the Blues Brothers, there's the moment when John Belushi gets hit by the sort of, you know, the light from God sort of thing, and goes, "We've got to put the band back together," you know, it's sort of a similar moment with Tatsu, but it's when he tastes the tattoo. I mean, that is the bit that you think is going to be, but it's actually a bit later on when the girl delivering the noodles sort of feeds it to him when he tastes it, and you get this sort of like sort of grainy sort of soft focus scene sort of back to his childhood of his mum sort of like feeding him noodles, you know. It's like, oh my god, it's like what my mum, you know, used to make me. And then later on, the other chef, Zin, he has a similar bit where he goes, you know, I don't want to be sort of doing this sort of piles and piles of food. I want to do something a bit more sort of delicate. And he tells this story about him going to this place and meeting this old woman who, you know, she runs this shop, but she can only serve four customers at a time, because, you know, she put so much effort into the food and that sort of thing. And it's a really sort of touching story, you know, and it's sort of so nicely told when he does it. And so, you know, he's making these noodles for Mimi at the same time. So, yeah, it, as you say, it does sort of pay homage to the humble noodle.
The food itself. So,
yeah, exactly.
The food itself is important.
Absolutely. So yeah, a lot of fun, this, you know, and it sort of goes a bit more sort of traditional sort of good guys versus bad guys towards the end, when sort of one of the characters gets kidnapped and they have to sort of come to a rescue. So yeah, a lot going on. it's an interesting film because, you know, I was watching it and thinking this would be a good sort of entry point for anyone wanting to sort of watch a bit of sort of strange Japanese sort of filmmaking. Because it's not too over the top. It's quite indie.
It's quite indie flick, isn't it? I mean, it's a small, you know, it's not a massive blockbuster, but it is like a really good, like you say, intro into their way of telling stories and the kind of things.
Yeah, it's very quirky. It's very, you know, it's very hip, very, very fun. It's not, you know, it's not gory or anything. I mean, this is from, this is from director Yoshihiro Nishimura, who did films like Tokyo Gore Police and Dead Sushi and Meatball Machine. So you can sort of kind of tell from those titles, you know, he does the sort of big gore effects basically in a lot of his films. But this is, you know, it's a different tack altogether. It's fun. It's a musical, which is weird, but it's got that sort of gangster element to it, but that doesn't sort of play out the way you expect. So yeah, this is it's a lot of fun and very different to what you might be expecting or not.
Well, I to be honest with you, I've put my expectations aside every time you send me something to watch.
That's probably a good way to do it. Yeah. It's probably worth not watching the trailer as well. I mean, one of the things in this, I usually rally against this thing that happens where you get these intro cards come in for the characters. You know, they introduce a character and their name is splashed across the screen. There's a film we reviewed recently called Knuckle Dust, which did that. And I'm thinking, it's 2020. Why are we still seeing this? You know, it's not bloody Quentin Tarantino doing Reservoir Dogs back in 1995 or wherever it was. You know, we're past that, surely, you know. But no, apparently we're not, you know. But with this one, I was like, I'll go with it. You know, I'll allow it on this occasion. It didn't bother me as much because it fit in with the rest of the film. You know, it fit in with this sort of style that they were presenting.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit eclectic, to be honest with you. I mean, they kept, you know, they had lots of different. I mean, for the most part, it was fairly kind of, you know, straightforwardly shot. But you know, when they'd just do certain scenes and they would really kind of go for it with a different, you know, a different kind of genre effect, you know, a different sort of, you know, and they were clearly just having fun. I mean, you know, this film, yes, it had the big banner kind of, you know, full screen splash titles at the start. It had musical, you know, all the bits with Kizumo, like, and his eyeball head gangsters was really sci-fi.
Yeah.
In a way. And in fact, I was thinking, actually, the thing that it made me think of was Kubrick's Clockwork Orange.
All right. Yeah. You know, and, with the jumpsuits. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But not just that, just the way that there was the kidnap scenes, you know, were like that, those kind of long shot vignettes that he did. And sorry. There was, you know, there was loads of different. So I think you can sort of forgive them for kind of like the big banner titles on the screen. Because they were doing loads of mad stuff.
Yeah, because they revisited later on, you know, just before they do the sort of, you know, attempt the rescue kind of thing, and they reintroduce all of the characters who are on the rescue with their weapons, you know, like it was a sort of Shaw Brothers kung fu movie, you know.
Or a video game. Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's just like to me, it was just like, yeah, that's like that's the title sequence to a 90s beat 'em up.
Yeah, sort of like side scrolling
shooter. Yeah, like a Tekken or something like that.
Yeah. Double Dragon.
Even better.
we can't recommend this enough. Basically, it's a lot of fun. The music's catchy. Just go with it, basically, and have fun with it, and you'll find yourself hankering for some pot noodles afterwards, I think.
Definitely.
So what are we going to score it, Will? Oh, and then he called you Rich then.
I like you say, I mean, I can't recommend this highly enough. It kept me entertained. It was funny, quirky, entertaining, and, you know, had substance to it. You know, I think we're quite stingy here on DTV though. You know, on the DTV Digest, we don't. I've never heard of a 10.
No, you know, we've never gone that high.
No, and I don't. I think really we got to, you know, it's like I'm looking for reasons not to give it a 9 really, and I'm not really finding any. There isn't anything bad about it. I mean, you know, everyone clearly was loving making this film, and it came over as just great fun, great entertainment, a good story, weirdly told, or a weird story well told. I don't know. I'm absolutely not sure which one it is. And I'm sort of thinking, I'd be mean not to give it a 9. I can't think of reasons why not to give it a 9, right, apart from we are just not that generous.
Fine. Yeah. Okay. A 9 from Will. And I am going to be a little bit stingy. I'm going to go with an 8. And I'm knocking a point off, mainly as we talked about the villain, Gazuma, being a bit, being a bit of whiny shit, basically. But,
fair enough.
But, you know, a very strong 8 and a 9 for Tokyo Dragon Chef. I will just also say that the credit sequence contains a preview for a proposed episode 2. Now, I'm just on IMDb at the moment. I just want to sort of double check something to see if it's if this is a, you know, an actual threat, you know, or a promise of something coming up.
There's not a lot on IMDb for this. I think they must have received the information for this on Friday afternoon.
I'm a bit annoyed with IMDb for this, because they've made no effort to sort of put the characters' names in.
There's nothing on it at all.
So Yoshihiro himself doesn't seem to be involved in a sequel, so it might just be a weird joke sort of put in at the end, or it might be a promise. Who knows? It'd be interesting to see, definitely, if they go down that route.
I'd check it out.
I think there's another little bit right at the end, sort of typical sort of Marvel kind of post-credit thing going on there. But definitely worth checking out. So this gets an 8 and a 9 from the DTV Digest from me and Will. So go check it out. Our next review is Silence and Darkness. Sisters Anna and Beth, one blind and the other is deaf, live happily in a secluded small town with their father. However, when a neighbor stops by, Anna and Beth begin to realize that their father's intentions may be more sinister than they could have imagined. So this is the first feature by a director called Barak Barkan. He's done a few shorts before. I had a quick look at them. They're quite fun, you know, sort of satirical kind of things about people's relationships. This is a very big sort of turn for him into sort of bigger territory. It is very slow paced. It's full of very long takes with not much happening. But at the same time, I found this quite engrossing. The characters especially sort of draw you in. So Anna and Beth, as we said, one is blind and the other is deaf. They sort of live a sort of almost sort of symbiotic sort of relationship. You know, they do sort of rely on each other, but at the same time are reasonably sort of independent. And they do have this sort of rather idyllic sort of lifestyle, sort of living out in this sort of, you know, this vast sort of countryside. And on the surface, we you know, when we meet their father, who's the local doctor, you know, he also seems to be, you know, quite benevolent and obviously doting on his daughters, and they certainly dote on him. But it's not long, Will, before that facade slips.
No, I'm not sure. It's the first clue that visit he has from his.
One of his patients. Mrs. Long, yeah.
Yeah, Mrs. Long kind of clues you in that dad has got some issues, you know, because that that whole completely inappropriate doctor's visit, you know, tells you straight away that he's not great, he's unethical, and also he's really, you know, he's just really weird. There's something really off kilter about him. And then, obviously, when he returns to the girls, you know, at the end of his working day, even before, you know, the scene where he, I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but it's hard to talk about this film without saying stuff.
I think we're gonna have to talk a little bit around what's going on. Otherwise, this would be the most vaguest review ever because there's not a lot of content really.
No, it's spread out over a long time. Mm. But you know, I mean, it's like you say, the girls do have like a really, they do have a symbiotic relationship because, you know, one hears for the other and the other one sees for the other.
Mm.
And, you know, when you see them working together to cook his birthday dinner, it's one of the first scenes. They're really happy and excited to be doing it. And you see how they sort of share the tasks, and it's like very seamless. And then the way they sort of communicate, because obviously, is it Beth who's deaf?
I think it's the other way around. I think Beth is the blind one.
Blind girl, right. And Anna's deaf. So obviously,
yeah.
We got it right. Beth can't. Anna can't see.
Yeah. So they can't use normal sign language. Beth. Yeah.
Yeah. So the way that they communicate is that it sort of put me in mind of that Helen Keller movie. You know, they do a sign language where they talk with their hands.
Yeah.
You know, they talk like you doing a contact sign language, which is quite fascinating to watch. You know, and how they sort of find each other when they're, you know, when they're in the same room, and how they sort of, you know, like you can kind of tell that. I mean, you know, I'm going to get this wrong, aren't I? So Anna can't hear, but she can feel.
Yes.
Beth can't see, but she can hear.
That's correct.
So you know, and it's because I was watching it at first, and I was wondering, I was trying to work out if both of them were deaf and blind, because I didn't read any blurb before I started watching it. And then you sort of then it kind of clicks because, you know, Beth is obsessed with music and she can sing and play, you know. And then there's that incredible scene where she's teaching her sister how to play guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Blind absolutely. Girl teaching a deaf girl how to play, and it's just incredible. It's just very, very clever how that, and it's when you sort of after you kind of see the happy family at the table when everything's great at the birthday party, and then he sings for them. But then after you realise that actually he's really wrong, he's just really wrong in the obvious way that you see at work. But then when he comes home, you start to realise that his relationship with the girls is just, it's wrong in a way that kind of slowly becomes more apparent.
It's interesting. I mean, the actor, Jordan Lage plays the father. And he's very good because he's wearing sort of two masks basically. So there's the doting father, you know, sort of like the mask he wears for the daughters and for the community at large, you know, sort of upstanding pillar of community and all the rest of it.
And hasn't he got it so hard looking after two girls who are, you know, have such obstacles in their lives?
But beneath that, we find out that he is conducting this sort of weird, psychopathic experiment on his daughters, and we get a glimpse of it through these tape recordings that he's making. We sort of hear him sort of talking about sort of the relationship between the two daughters you know, whether or not it's he's musing out loud a lot, whether or not he can sort of drive a wedge between them and sort of see how they cope and all this sort of stuff. And
so he talks, when you realize he's talking about them like the guinea pigs, you know, immediately it just, that the film just takes on an immediate sort of shift. We get his exposition through those tapes, and we learn very quickly what's going on in his, like basically the thing that make him such a deeply menacing character, because he is menacing. He's a menacing figure, and he goes from being that the good doctor with the, you know, caring so hard for his daughters and so on, bringing them up on his own because the wife's not there, and he goes from that to being this really menacing, you know, God, how do we define him, kind of person. But the girls, the film is slow because all of those kind of lengthy shots of the girls doing stuff is because it takes that long to really get us into their viewpoint.
Yeah.
Like, because they can't communicate. It would be really trite and crass to try and have them explain how it feels to be them, and it also wouldn't work. So like, I think it did, I sort of realized that you have to take that time to build up.
Yeah.
How do they experience the world?
I mean, one of my two favorite scenes in the film are, you know, the one we just talked about earlier, was where Beth's teaching Anna how to play the guitar, which I thought was superb. The other bit is Beth gets up in the middle of the night and hears a sound outside. Yeah. And then the next day, she gets Anna to sort of go out, and she's sort of giving her directions. So okay, you make a digging sound over there. And it's like, no, it's not quite there. Go further back, you know. But it's all done through sign language, and you know, it's absolutely brilliant.
It's fantastic from a distance, isn't it? Because
it's all in one shot. Well, it takes two shots basically, but you know, both characters are in shot all the time. Even though it's sort of
perfect. Very, very. That scene was brilliant. I thought that scene was extremely, like, cleverly done. I don't want to talk about the end, but I kind of do, because the the ultimate scene, you know, the scene where it all comes to a head, is the first time when they, like, the director and cinematographer actually put you in their,
literally behind their eyes, in their heads, while this
very dramatic scene is playing out. And by the time it was a long film, but to get to that point at the end, it was worth it, because that was fantastic. It couldn't be any other way. You couldn't not show it from their points of view.
Yeah, but the I mean, just to go back as well, talking about the father, I mentioned this, he's wearing sort of two masks, because he sees himself, I guess, as this sort of dispassionate individual who, as you say, you know, he's looking upon his two daughters as these sort of guinea pigs, basically. But I think he's, to a certain degree, he's fooling himself. You know, he's fooling everyone else with his upstanding character and everything, but he's also fooling himself into thinking, oh no, this is all just an experiment. I'm just here, you know, I'm doing this totally detached from my emotions and stuff. But it's very apparent he becomes very jealous. Of the two, his reaction. You got the girls enter this talent competition, which is why Beth teaches Anna how to play guitar, so they can do this Bob Dylan number. That this talent competition, and afterwards, when he's doing his little tape recordings to himself, he's sort of talking about it, sort of going, well, that was a bit lackluster. Well, that was a bit rubbish. I'm sure everyone else thought it was rubbish as well. You know, I'm thinking, yeah, you're absolutely jealous of what, you know, how capable they are and what they're able to achieve despite their thing. And then he goes to a hell of an extreme measure.
Oh,
I won't go into what it is, but I was so fucking shocked. Yeah. You know, I mean, this earlier stuff, which is creepy as fuck, like you know, where he sedates them so that they are wholly dependent on him. You know,
that's what it's all about, isn't it? Is that he can't bear.
Yeah, he can't bear their independence, and you know, and he wants to sort of keep them in that sort of regressed state, and which was fucking creepy in itself, because if it wasn't for Mrs. Bishop knocking on the door, I'm thinking, where is this
guy? Where would he have gone?
But anyway,
I mean, like you say, that was an extreme measure. He took an extreme measure to try and, like you say, drive a wedge to try and keep them dependent. And it won't, I mean, obviously, because we can't go into detail about that, because it is a crucial moment in the film. But, you know, how they sort of develop from that is actually quite a satisfying moment as well. There's moments after that where you think, even before things reach their ultimately dramatic conclusion, there's a scene where you're thinking, actually, I think it would take him. He would have to try a lot harder than that. Even as horrific as it is, that surprised me. This film, when it starts off, you really just think, bloody hell, am I going to be able to make it? I'll be honest.
Yeah, I mean, was the same. Yeah.
You know, it's beautifully shot. I think I read that it was shot in Vermont, which is an absolutely stunning part of the world and the American sort of, it was New England, isn't it? The eastern, eastern side of the US. And it's fantastic, but it's lonely and it's quiet, and it's very still. Mm. And there's an awful lot of static shots in this, in the build-up of this film, of like vignettes of, you know, of just sort of still shots of people not doing very much, and I think you have to put in a little bit of effort before it starts giving back to you, because it is just so still, quiet, and slow.
If the two girls weren't so likable, this would be a hard slog, you know. But the fact that they are, that, you know, the characters are so engaging, and
I think they're ones to watch. I'll say it, because they're acting. I didn't actually check yet to see whether they were, you know, it, you know, because I remember watching The Quiet Place, and the girl who played the main daughter in that, she's deaf in real life. She's a deaf deaf actor.
I didn't see any comments in their IMDb pages to suggest they are either blind or deaf,
but their acting to suggest it is
very good,
superlative.
Yeah,
they're definitely. I mean, I need to find their names actually. I didn't prep myself.
It's Joan Glackin plays Anna, and Mina Walker plays Beth, and I may have got them mixed up as to who's the blind one and who's the deaf one, but but the girl playing the deaf one, I mean, she's really into Bob Dylan and this sort of stuff, and there's sort of moments when she's sort of just rocking out, and it's like she just looks so cool what she's doing, you know, and she's wearing her sunglasses. I'm thinking, yeah, you're not wearing sunglasses because you're blind. You're wearing sunglasses because you know you look cool.
Exactly, because you want to be like Bob Dylan, basically. Yeah. And she, you know,
that's really cool. Yeah. It's interesting the fact that she can sort of get on with her music and stuff and not bother her sister at all. You know, it's never going to be a point where it's like, you're annoying me with your music all the time. So, yeah, I can't hear it. You know, I can just get on and do what I want to do.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, because you sort of, you're watching this with a certain amount of filmic language background of if a person, you know, that you're watching on screen is deaf and surrounded by music, or if they're blind and surrounded by, you know, by visual things, by the beauty of the landscape, or, you know, their family's faces, or what's going on. You're watching it basically. You're almost waiting for the moment where that character is frustrated at what they haven't got.
Yeah.
You know, or is it somehow at a disadvantage because of what they haven't got? You do not ever get that with these characters.
No.
They are complete largely because of the other person. But even, you know, even as you know, as individuals, they are complete because that's their whole experience, and they've lived around it for their whole lives. And in actual fact, like, yeah, being able to share your love of music with your sister who can't hear it so effectively, you know, it's just, to me, you know, just in the sense of looking at they're in what, because they refer to them as impairments. He refers to them as impairments in that the girls don't feel that they're impaired at all.
No,
one bit. Right. They're just living within their experience, and like, you know, they're complete with their impairments. So,
yeah. We're not, without actually sort of revealing what it is again, and sort of just going back to the ending, because we get sort of this climactic thing that happens. And you may, you know, when it happens, you may still be on the fence as to whether our perception of what's happened is correct, or if we're just sort of reading into, reading sort of malevolent intentions into it. But then there's the scene at the end in the car where they play the last tape or play one of the early tapes, and it just brings it all home to the actual horror of what this guy has done, and it is devastating, basically. Fuck, man.
Yeah, it's because it's like a weird time delay thing, because he just reframes it and you just realise really just what he was like at heart.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean the there is also, like, because you might be doubtful about the sound in the woods. I mean, I think you're deliberately supposed to be doubtful about the sound in the woods, for a long time. And the girl's best efforts to try and identify what was happening, what he was doing in the woods, don't actually come to fruition.
Exactly, and that's interesting in itself, isn't it? Because a lot of films would have allowed
them to discover something.
Yeah,
but
it never goes there. It's like there's something going on, but maybe there isn't.
They try really hard, and you're kind of on the edge of your seat, thinking, and if it's there, if the thing's there to be found, they'll find it, because they're ingenious. Like you mentioned, that ingenious scene where they're looking for it. It's just actually quite fun talking about this film in this way, because I really don't. I would recommend that if you're not aware of any of this film, you don't know what is happening in it, don't find out before you watch it, because it's well worth things that work. With you not having any knowledge whatsoever of what's coming up.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're going to score this, Will. How are you going to score this out of 10?
I think as a technical and acting, like, example, this needs at least an 8. I think that for the two girls' performance, they were that, what were their names again? I want to name them.
Joan Glackin and Mina Walker are the two.
Yeah,
two girls.
Yeah. And what's his name again? Larkin.
Jordan Lage is
Jordan Lage. Yeah. Jordan Lage, like, the fantastic, brilliant script, technical brilliant script, because you've got one person in it who can't actually deliver verbal lines, but manages to be a presence on stage. Yeah, it's got to be at least an 8 just for the performance.
I totally agree. This film is going to try some people's patience. If you're sort of more inclined to sort of a quicker pace, then you probably may want to avoid this. But if you can allow the film to just wash over you and get to know the characters, and I think by the time you find out exactly what Father is actually like, then you will be sort of hooked into this. So that's 2 8s for Silence and Darkness. Our next review is Sator. Now, I'm just going to read out what the blurb is on IMDb, and then we'll discuss that. So this is how IMDb describes this film. Secluded in a desolate forest, a broken family is observed by Sator, a supernatural entity who is attempting to claim them. Now, Will, does that sentence resonate with you with anything you've just watched?
No.
Not at all. So this is what I shall try and describe what I watched. So we've got this character called Adam, who we meet deep in this forest. We're not entirely sure why he's there to begin with, but he's got a few sort of motion sensor cameras set up around and about, and he's got this very weird sort of whistle that's been sort of whittled out of a piece of wood that he keeps blowing as well. Ooh. And for the first 12 minutes of this film, it is literally just him and his dog walking around the forest or sitting at his laptop trying to look at pictures of stuff that he's recorded. And that is it for at least 12, 15 minutes of the film. And then all of a sudden, this other guy just appears in his cabin.
Yeah, just walks in.
It just turns up. And it turns out that this is actually his brother called Pete, who had been in a mental hospital, we find out at the end of the film, for a while, and had come up to sort of visit him. And yeah, this it is very difficult to sort of work out what the timeline for this film is. It's very non-linear. It keeps jumping about sort of various things going on. Throughout the film, there is this narration, which I thought was from his grandmother, but it turns out to be from his mother who disappeared. So we get this in this very sort of creepy, very atmospheric, it has to be said, sort of diatribe, which is sort of this sort of narration. And supposedly his grandmother was like channeling spirits and doing like spirit writing, I think it's called.
Automatic writing.
And you know, she'd written reams and reams of this stuff, and then her mother sort of put it down onto tape. And that's kind of it, really. Yeah. Story-wise, yeah. it's you know, this guy trying to make contact with this Sator thing, or you know, trying to stop him from getting involved in his family. In which case, I'd say stay away from the fucking forest.
I don't understand why he's there. I honestly do.
This is Sator's stomping ground, and you go there and keep blowing this whistle, trying to, you know, get him to appear. And then, I mean, brilliantly, he does appear, or something appears in the cabin, and which is a brilliant cut where he suddenly turns around, and then suddenly this thing is sat in the chair behind him, which was absolutely brilliantly done. At which point, it's time to go.
Yeah.
Seriously, you know.
You'd think
it'd be time to go by that point, but no. There's some other little bits going on. The thing I really liked, and something I always do like, is when technology reveals something.
You know?
And there's a bit with this photo that is taken by the motion sensor camera, and when he first looks at it, it's like, well, he's just taking a photograph of the trees, you know, in darkness. But then he sort of shoots the brightness up to maximum, and then you can see these figures hidden between the trees. And I thought, I love shit like that.
Yeah, that is quite cool. And the figures themselves. I mean, again, they're not don't want to sort of give away and spoil them, but the figures are really quite. They are very, very
it's,
well
it's done. It's really good, yeah. And funny enough, before recording this, I was watching the new version of Wrong Turn. There's a sort of revamp of Wrong Turn, and they've got a very similar design of, you know, using like I don't know, I suppose like elk skulls as sort of masks and stuff like that. It's really effective.
I think it's very, I mean, because the stuff I read on IMDb about this was saying it was like trying to be a folklore tradition. And like that character, it's almost, you know, that's almost like you go back to Celtic imagery of you know, the sort of the kind of animist things and the things in the forest, you know, or even the paintings from the cave of beasts in, you know, like the sort of cave painting.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff. And it's, I mean, I suppose that's quite a kind of obvious thing for a supernatural thing set in the woods. But it's just done well, and you can tell that it's been done. This film's been made with not a lot of money, and they've done really well actually, considering that. You know what I mean, it's what
it's got going for me is a great atmosphere, superb locations, and superb cinematography. And brilliant sound design as well. I mean, I think it's worth watching this on headphones, unless you've got a good sound, surround sound system. Watch it with headphones, because when Adam, you know, he's walking through the woods and he can hear noises off in the distance. And if you're wearing headphones, you know, you can really discern which direction the sounds are coming from. You know, and it does sort of help build that atmosphere, I find.
I mean, because there's an awful lot of thought, like you say. I hadn't really, you know, thought to mention it, but there's a lot of thought put into what's the stuff that's almost not audible. Right the way, not even just in those scenes in the woods, but right the way through, they're sort of little voices and things like that happening, you know, that are creepy, that build the creepiness, you know, gradually, very gradually.
I think that the main difference between you know, again, this is a film with lots of long takes, you know, sort of lots of silence as well, you know, because Adam's spending a lot of time in the zone. Even when his brother Pete turns up, I mean, Pete is stoic as hell, you know. I think he has about sort of five lines of dialogue in the whole film.
Yeah.
You know, it is, you know, not many people talk much in here apart from this one. And I think no, that's
but,
the main
but Pete
difference.
Makes him, Pete makes Adam, you know, Pete like Adam is almost practically silent.
Yeah.
I don't know I'm trying to remember what he's actually said to anyone about anything in that film.
And like no, he just sort of nods or something, isn't it?
Yeah. And Pete makes him look even quieter. And Pete hasn't even got that much to say. The person who talks the most is the grandmother. And a lot of what she says doesn't help you understand or make sense of what's going on.
Not at all, because you don't know how much of it is just in her head.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because she's sort of suffering from
dementia,
basically, as well. Yeah, on top of everything. But I think what, you know, the main difference between this and Silence and Darkness, which is the one we just reviewed, is that it doesn't really draw you into the characters as much. You know, you're very much sort of on the outside of these people's heads, and you know, you're left to just observing their actions or lack of them. Whereas with the previous film, we've got these characters, Anna and Beth, you know, you're much more engaged in what they're doing you know, sort of worried about them, shall we say.
Sorry to cut you off, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this one, you look at them going, you've got a clear choice here. You know, you've got a clear choice to sort of leave this stuff alone and just go, you know, but no, you want to see it through. Whereas
but you're not even sure what it is he's trying to see through. That's the thing.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That completely puzzled me. Yeah. The reason why Silence and Darkness kind of reached out more. I mean, you had to give it time, but it reached out more and drew you in, made you be bothered about the girls. Is because even though most of their dialogue was silent, and you weren't actually given, you don't know what they're saying when they're talking with their hands, like with their contact sign language thing.
Yeah.
They are talking, and you are inferring a huge amount of who they are in their relationship by their responses and reactions. They are conversing, and even if you don't understand it, Pete and Adam, like, it's pretty much all one way. In fact, Adam's interactions with everyone in that film are one way. You still have no idea. I think you needed a little bit more than he was able to give with his, you know, script.
I think so. But other than that, you know, this does have a lot going for it, but it is another sort of one that's going to test your patience, I think, overall. It's got great visuals. It has, you know, great sound design. It looks great. It's just that there's not a hell of a lot going on. And, you know, the characters are difficult to engage with. So I think on that basis, I'm giving this one a 7 out of 10.
Agreed. I mean, it seems cruel, because it's not like anyone in that film wasn't trying. You know, they were convincing characters. It's just that I felt I needed more from more to understand what the hell Adam was actually doing out there. And the final quarter does seem to wrap it up a bit. You know, when the figures turn up and the festivities really start to kick off. But yeah, I'll go with that. 7 scenes.
Yeah. There is one bit which just totally threw me. There's one bit where he has a sort of dream sequence, and I'm pretty fucking sure there's a UFO flying over.
Yes, absolutely. I was like, do you remember that film? Oh my god, I think it was Billy Bob Thornton, a Coen
brother. Oh yeah, yeah, the Fire in the Sky. Yeah.
No, the man who wasn't there. I think it was.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like just randomly, the UFO turns up over the prison. and then goes away again. Like, then that's it.
And never gets referred to again. Yeah. Jesus
like,
Christ.
Yeah.
I'm glad you spotted that, because I was like,
I was imagining it. I thought I was imagining it as well. I thought, yeah, is that am I not seeing it clearly? Yeah.
Exactly. What the fuck's that meant to be? Yeah, bizarre. Anyway, so Sator gets 2 sevens from me and Will. Our short shot this week is Quixotic Highway Violence. In this one, we have a group of women who are playing a video game, and then the short takes us into the game, and we get to see the live action version of it. So this is a really good pastiche of some 80s and 90s sort of tropes. Things like Terminator 2, Back to the Future, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, that sort of thing, all done to this really cool synth score done by this band called Quixotic. Rich, how did you find this?
Yeah, it's excellent. I came across it from the, I think it was Twitter or Facebook, from the Maze Brothers, who did Cyborg, Deadly Machine.
Yeah, there's you can see the sort of similarities there.
It's definitely, you know, in their wheelhouse. It's the same kind of thing. It's also like Kung Fury, mm-hmm. All those things. It's actually, there's no dialogue in this. It's essentially a music video. But it's got, you know, a full film sort of feel to it. They open up with an Orion style logo, which also I think Maze Brothers also did. And then, you know, opening credits, quite long closing credits. The film itself, so it's 11 minutes, but the actual the end credits start at about 5 minutes.
Because
there's so many people involved in bringing the various parts of it to life. Into, you know, it's a visual effects, showcase, as much as it is for the for Quixotic, who's a Hungarian synthesized music recording artist.
I've looked them up on Spotify, and I'm going to be falling asleep to their music later tonight. so they do a great version of like the underground car park chase scene from Terminator 2. With a guy sort of dressed as the T-1000 sort of chasing the car. They do a really good version. And the guy does a good impression of Robert Patrick, even to the point where when he gets hit by bullets, he does that sort of spinning out sort of thing, sort of getting knocked back and then sort of continuing running. I thought that was really good. It was a really good pastiche.
Yeah, it's the whole the project is been brought to life to play, say, for this. The tune is called Highway Violence. I think it comes from an album that he did a few years ago. So it's like something that's been gestating for quite some time. But it's, it's as with them, with his music, which is very 80s, and that influence, he's done one called Schwarzenegger, which is all, features like bits of the Terminator theme and Arnie talking and stuff and other things that nod to video games like Outrun, which this film does. It's that 6 minute or 5 or 6 minutes of that music, and the story, like you say, is these girls are in an arcade setting. What could be more 80s than that? And the visualization of all these things, just all these ideas being thrown at the screen. So it starts off as one thing, then it changes to. So it starts off in a Ferrari, and then it goes into Star Wars. Back to the Future. So constantly changing to all these iconic cars and stuff. There's a Mad Max scene. There's, in addition to that, there's lots of other little references to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and there's a sign for Nakatomi Plaza when they're driving along. Skynet.
Skynet at the beginning. There's also a nod to Stranger Things.
Yes. Yeah.
And there was another one. Was it Pine Hill, Tree Hill or something? I can't remember what it's called now.
Hill Valley from
Hill Valley, Back to the Future, of course. Yeah.
And there's also one of the great visual effects in the movie is when he pulls up at this diner, which has got all sorts of people outside of it. But there's a Millennium Falcon taking off or landing just behind the diner. It's brilliantly done. It looks really great. The tune is excellent. As you might, if you like synth wave stuff, synthesized music, it's definitely a must see. And just count the references and stuff. It's really good fun. A bit different to what we normally do. It's not a narrative film by any stretch of the imagination.
No,
it's well worth seeing.
Absolutely, yeah. So this is on YouTube. We'll put the link to the short in the footnotes as we usually do. So definitely check this out. It's a lot of fun. It's 6 minutes. Unless you want to watch all the credits as well. There is a sort of tiny sort of after credits bit as well. Definitely worth checking out. And the music's great. I have to say, the music is superb. Our DTV throwback this week is Warlock the Armageddon. An order of druids train their children to battle an evil warlock determined to unleash Satan upon the world by bringing a collection of five mystic runestones together. Now, Rich, I mentioned last week, I'd seen the original Warlock film at the cinema. You know, it was my introduction to Richard E. Grant as an actor and Julian Sands, of course. But I'd never seen the sequels.
Had you heard of it?
Oh, yeah, of course I've heard of it.
You knew there were sequels.
Yeah, I knew there were sequels. But the thing for me, the draw for the first one was Richard E. Grant.
Right.
So knowing he wasn't in the sequel put me off, I think, at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, but what an idiot I was. What an idiot I was for not watching this back in the day, because this is a lot of fun indeed. Some of the visual effects do not stand up to the test of time, unfortunately. They are very dated at times. But overall, Julian Sands is fucking brilliant in this. And every time he's on screen, you know, this really works. The story of the sort of the warlock, the druids and their sons and daughters and things, not as good, I don't think, but it's a very inventive story, you know, very, very inventive sort of kill scenes and that sort of thing going on. So yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this.
What's your memory of the first film? Would you be able to put it in context to fill me in on the backstory?
So the first one, haven't you seen it?
I have seen it once, many, many years ago, but it didn't make much of an impression.
All right. So Richard E. Grant plays this sort of witchfinder general kind of guy who captures Julian Sands' warlock. But he sort of makes a pact with the sort of the devil, shall we say, and is transported to the future, and Richard E. Grant gets sort of sucked through the wormhole with him. Mm-hmm. And then I can't remember what he has to do. He has to sort of collect something, some bits and pieces. And Richard E. Grant's character is helped by this young lady who...
Was it Laurie Singer?
Laurie Singer, yeah. I was going to say Meg Ryan, but yeah, Laurie Singer. And it's really good, really nasty at times as well. You know, some nasty ideas. He kills a kid and then sort of melts his skin to make a flying potion, you know. Although, you know, it's all off screen, but even so, you know, the idea that sort of that's how bad your bad guy is. But yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed that film. I remember seeing it a couple of times.
It sounds to me like the two films fit together better than I'd thought they did, because I always think of the first one as being like a fantasy movie, and this is like a full-on horror film with some fantasy elements, but it almost like, you know, a complete standalone. It's not really, nothing is referenced from the first film. It's like he might not even be playing the same character, it's just he happens to look the same and they've used the title Warlock. Is how it seemed to me. So it's interesting to hear you say about the...
Yeah, no, I got the impression that Julian Sands was playing the same character.
Yeah, and he's got the... Because I always thought... My memory of the first one was that it wasn't set in the present, that it was more of a period kind of thing. But from what you're saying, it sounds a bit like they did a Highlander thing of starting out in the old times and then maybe all of us, or obviously with travel through portals or whatever. So that's quite interesting. But this is more, am I fair to say that this is more of a horror film than the first one was, or was the first one quite horror anyway?
There are some horror elements in the first one. Like, for example, he goes to see this medium and sort of kill, you know, she gets possessed by this demon. And then he says, how are you going to help me? He goes, use my eyes. So he sort of has to dig her eyes out. Yeah, sort of thing. It has its little moments. I think this ups the ante for sure. There's a really classic bit in when one of the druids inadvertently ends up in a lift with the guy, and then tries to take him out himself. And it just, you know, it cuts from like the, you know, him sort of trying to stab him to the warlock sort of walking out of the lift and it's just like wall to wall blood and guts. Yeah. It's like...
I was going to highlight that as one of my favorite bits in the movie, because yeah. there are some great set piece kills. It's basically the warlock. There's two stories unfolding. One is preparing the youngsters or the youngster and his girlfriend for the encounter that's going to come. And then the warlock's journey as he goes around collecting these runestones. So it's like, go to a place, kill someone in an interesting way, go to another place, kill someone.
Yeah.
So it's that slasher movie kind of thing. But of all the kills, and there's some really, really good ones, the understatedness of that scene and the way it was cut, because some of the way the film is edited really bugged me, especially in the first half. It's like, you got like a bit of a scene here and then it cuts away and you've got like 2 seconds of another bit and then it cuts back. And it feels a bit disjointed. But by the time you get to the end, the editing's really solid. And I love the way, you know, he like lifts the dagger and it's just a very quiet cutaway to movie. I'm sure I've seen that in other movies, but it's really well done. This is made by Anthony Hickox, who was on a hell of a run at the time, having started out with Waxwork and then done things like Sundown, Waxwork 2. Hellraiser 3, notably, was the one he did before this. And you can feel it. There's the same kind of feel to the movie, I think.
There's a great cameo in this as well.
From Waxwork,
From Zach Galligan is his name.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite funny.
Yeah, because this film's got that Terminator 2 kind of thing going on. And they do the kind of I want your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle kind of scene. But you know, because Terminator 2 it's just come out. So there's lots of little bits, intentionally or not, that are nodding to Terminator. There's even like almost like a liquid metal kind of, actually there's a couple.
There's a good melting effect at the end.
Effect at the end. There's a bit where the warlock, I think he passes something through himself. I think that's very much like something that was in T2. But
he gets impaled on a branch and then he's able to sort of morph his way out of it.
Yeah, the morphing, that's the word I was trying to think. And so morphing was quite the new big thing that James Cameron had kind of set off with Industrial Light and Massive, and that, and they'd kind of set that free. So there's lots of visual effects in this movie. Star Wars, unusually, I hadn't thought about it at the time, but watching it this time, I'm like, he's Luke Skywalker, that boy. You know, and there's a whole China training thing, and it's like the orb on is it in the first film or the second film where he's got the orb kind of moving around him, and
See, unfortunately, that's the bit that really ages the film, is so the visual effects of the sort of floaty bits, you know, with the baseball and things like that, which is a bit too silly. You know, there's better sort of practical effects going on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the practicals are great. I mean, it's the visual effects, the picture quality changes, doesn't it? You notice, so it's...
Yeah,
it you, gets you mentioned, sort of weird.
You mentioned Star Wars there, you know, so this is very much like Star Wars. I was wondering if it was a bit too much like Star Wars in that you've got these two characters, Sam and, I can't remember the name of the girl,
I think I know where you're going with this.
Because, you know, it's sort of like hinted... that both their mothers died in childbirth, and I was wondering if it was the same mother.
Yeah, me too,
because it's left hanging there, you know, because she's sort of saying, who am I sort of thing, and so, well, your mother died at the same time as his mother. It's like, could it be the same mother?
Are you related in some way that might be uncomfortable
considering where you end up later on. This is great fun. I mean, I'm a big fan of Julian Sands as well. I mean, it's a pity that Boxing Helena happened, really. But you know, I think he's really good in these the two Warlock films for sure.
Yeah, he decided he wasn't going to turn up for the third. They got Bruce Payne for that one.
They do sort of look a bit similar, don't they? The two, they got a similar look in their eyes, I think.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, they're both from around the same time. Bruce Payne was doing like
Passenger 57.
That was his big one. And they both turn up in kind of the same kind of movies even now. They sort of mix and match. You can sort of see them regularly. What I didn't think of. I mean, because I had this on video when it came out, so it was lovely to see it in widescreen this time. But what I hadn't seen at that point was the films that would come after, which seemed to have clearly been influenced by it. And so this Wishmaster in particular seems to owe a huge amount to this movie, because it's the same idea of, you know, this villainous entity who's born. He's born, and then he finds someone, puts on this human suit.
That's a really good bit.
He's walking around in a suit, being all charming and killing people in interesting ways, sort of twisting their words and, you know, their desires. Say, what do you,
That was an interesting bit as well. You know, the fact that he couldn't just take these rune stones, you know, they had to be given willingly to him.
So it's all about manipulation.
Yeah, which gave it a really interesting sort of twist.
So the Wishmaster, the first one, that was several years later, I think from the same company that made this. I might be wrong, but I think it was. Also, The Prophecy, which we covered
Chris Walken a few months ago,
is very similar, you know, in type. So you've got Christopher Walken's character turning these, I think in that case, he's sort of reanimating people to sort of do his bidding and be his like driver and stuff. You know, the same thing happens in this movie, which was a year or two before. And again, the plotting and stuff. And I asked Matthew Budrevich, Dave Wayne's mate, about him, what he thought. And he mentioned something Kim Newman had said in one of his books, saying that basically the Warlock Wishmaster and Prophecy films are somewhat interchangeable. So I feel sort of validated in that sort of judgment that I came, that there definitely seems to be some sort of trail that sort of takes us back to this fairly forgotten film that seems to have been quite influential overall. I mean, Wishmaster, interestingly, was also basically a reworking of Hellraiser 3, which was from the same director. So he kind of took Hellraiser 3 and Warlock and made something new, maybe throwing in a bit of Leprechaun. But yeah, fantastic. The kills in this are great. Say, really practical. I like the actors. The cast is brilliant. Paula Marshall and her eyebrows made a hell of an impression on me when I was a boy, and she's still there. She still looks great, and she was in Hellraiser 3 as well. Bruce Glover is in there as her father, the priest.
Yeah,
so he's really good. We've also got the guy. I think it's Charles Hallahan. But do you remember in the Lethal Weapon series, the guy who's their captain?
Oh yeah.
So he's the dad of the boy in this, who's played by Chris Young, who was in the John Candy movie, The Great Outdoors, which I coincidentally watched recently.
Am I wrong or not? But wasn't one of the guys also... Charles Hallahan. You went for Lethal Weapon. I went The Thing with him.
Oh, yes. Okay, yeah, sure. Yeah. Am I thinking of the right guy? Because there's two actors, and they're quite... there's one of the other... basically, the guy who goes in the lift. He's another very familiar character actor, and I wasn't sure if he was Hallahan. I don't know their names well enough to know which one's which, but they're both very familiar character actors. Which one was from The Thing, of course. Which, again, was kind of...
I think you might be confusing him with somebody else.
Yeah, I have to...
he was in Vision Quest.
So, Travis, Will Travis? Oh, let me go and hang on. Oh, so the father is played by Steve Kahan. See, I never even knew that name. I'd never even heard. I've never even picked up on it. But he's a really familiar character actor. Lethal Weapon is the films that I always think of him from, because he's just so memorable in those. But he's also been in like Demolition Man and what else? A few, not as many films as you would expect. I think the last thing he's credited on is 16 Blocks. With Bruce Willis in 2006. Seems like the Lethal Weapon movies were probably the most significant thing he's generally done. But yeah, he's really good in this as the dad. I like the fact that the plot focuses on these older gentlemen and not just on the kids, which, are, you know, a horror movie like this would normally be he's the boy discovering his destiny or whatever and doing it on his own. in this case, you know, his dad's right there all the time, guiding him through it.
Yeah.
Literally taking him to hell and back in one scene, and the other druids, the other druid guys. So there's different facets. You've got the young love story. You've got the older guys who've got this burden of responsibility in trying to sort out this problem that they've been preparing for hundreds of years, you know, passed down to them. And then you've got the full-on horror story of the warlock and his
having fun.
It's really, really, really good film. Really brief, you know, well-paced. It's only about 90 minutes.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and it's available on Amazon Prime. And as Richard mentioned earlier, it's in a nice widescreen print as well, which, you know, wasn't available on VHS back in the day. So this is definitely worth checking out. I thoroughly recommend the first one, but you don't need to see it for this. No, you know, just a standalone film. Definitely check it out. And that's the end of this week's show. So thank you for Will and Rich for joining me to talk about these wonderful films. You can find the trailers in the footnotes, as well as Quixotic's Highway Violence film. Don't forget to check us out on Twitter and Facebook, where you'll find the DTV chart and news about new releases as well. Other than that, thank you for listening and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.